Welcome to the Ohana Life Podcast, where we try to bring to you people in the health and wellness fields to help you along your journey, this journey of being human and all that comes with it. In this episode, I was able to speak with Brenda Quinn, who's a psychotherapist that is local here to the studio. She was so kind to give us a lot of her time to talk through some of the ways that we can face the challenges of today, which include COVID, how to negotiate through different thoughts that we have and some of that self-talk, how to consciously use the brain as a muscle. We talked about the polyvagal theory and her thought swapping therapies that are actually called neurological therapy. We spoke about the states of the nervous system and how to pause. And we also talked about ways to have those feelings of self-love just for better overall health in the body and the mind. So I hope that you enjoy this episode. There is a lot to it. I am going to include in the episode notes most of the books that she had talked about and some of the theories, so you don't have to worry about writing those down. So if you feel triggered in any way by any of this, feel free to pause the recording and you can take this in bite-sized chunks. All right. I hope that you do find some value of this and enjoy. Hi, Brenda.
Hi, Lisa. How are you?
Good. How are you doing today?
Good. It's good to see you.
You
well,
too.
On a screen. Yeah.
You on a screen. So we are actually recording this. I don't usually tell people that, but this is the day before the election. And so tensions are high. There's just a lot going on with people. And I really wanted to bring you in to help people understand maybe their emotions better, mm-hmm. how to kind of stay in their own lane with the emotions, how to process them, how to know when they're kind of getting out of control. So we have a lot to talk about today. Mm-hmm. So first, I would love for people to maybe know your professional background.
Sure. Well, I'm a licensed psychotherapist. Right now I'm in private practice and have been for about, I think going on 12 years now. But prior to that, I've done kind of other more administrative gigs, being a professor and a administrator of health centers and consultant to health centers at colleges. And consultant to corporations and things like that. So I've done other things, case management, director of QA and training, things like that. Kind of a diverse beginning. And then when my kids were, somewhat more launched, and I kind of moved back into private practice, and always kept it on my plate a little bit because it is my first love. But because of the amount of myself I find I hand over to it, it was best that I have a better life balance if I waited for a little bit longer and did that. And now I just absolutely love it. So that's what I'm doing, mostly doing some writing and presenting on the side, that kind of thing. But I'm working on some writing, on some ideas of integrating neurological therapy into effective parenting techniques, the idea of conscious parenting, which I've been working on for a while, but and getting some help in the writing because that's not my forte. I can speak a blue streak and can't write any color of a streak. So, but I do a lot of presenting at various conferences, the NASW conference, things like that. And a lot of that has been on issues related to anxiety, depression. They're cousins. They provoke one another. They're neurologically related to imbalance and lack of care, self-care. And the way I approach it is what I call, and it doesn't exist anywhere per se, but it's what I call and practice, is the idea of neurological therapy, with the understanding that physical therapy people have no problem going in for and saying, you know, my knee hurts, my ankle hurts. And then they go home and they do the exercises and things like that. And I find it helpful to have people notice that it's a similar approach to our neurology. It's a type of, it's not really a muscle, obviously, but it's a use it, lose it demographic. That's what works in the brain. If you use it, you keep it. If you don't, you lose it. And also what fires together, wires together, Hebb's rule. So things that touch together and touch together routinely create strong bonds and efficient bonds. And when you look at that and then you understand the brain a little bit more as something that belongs to you to be cared for, then you can be much more conscious in your approach to neurological self-care, which is body-mind self-care. It's all one. We never should have split them up. Right. So that's kind of what the approach I take now, which is a little bit different. And I'm trying to put that into some kind of written format because people have asked me over and over again, can you give me that in writing? And I'm like, that would mean I'd have to write it. And I don't want to, but I'm trying.
Again, I'm not a writer, but I will talk you out of anything.
Exactly.
So are you finding that you have more people than ever right now?
Yes. Yeah. And honestly, that is a universal experience. I can't even refer people, sadly. Clinicians are taking more people than they have, you know, were on their caseload before. You know, we're doing weird hours. I find that the group that I consult with, but also the extended group that we all know, we're having a hard time even finding folks to refer to. There's a very high level of need. Folks that we haven't seen in a while are coming back to just kind of touch base again and remember what they learned. And I think honestly, some of it's a touch of attachment. Is finding a secure and healthy attachment that can give them feedback that they know will put them back on the right path. But yeah, too much need and not enough resource.
Oh, that's so sad. Okay. Yeah. So this is definitely needed so that people can try to help themselves first before they can get in.
Yeah.
So you deal with adults or children or both?
Both. I guess people have felt like I'm an expert in more the teens and children category, but I see folks from their 70s all the way down to 5 or 3. And when you're getting into the little kid years, you're really doing system work and family work as much as you're working with the child. But some of the work I do with EMDR, which is a technique, is really incredibly effective with kids. So I do the whole gamut and probably am best known, if you will, for my work with kids and teens. I see a lot of teens and young adults. So, but I see it's kind of healthy to practice across the whole age spectrum because it reminds you of where you come from and where you go and helps me integrate all that. So, but mostly awesome. Kids, yeah.
So can you tell me the difference between a psychotherapist and a psychologist?
Sure. A psychotherapist is a master's level degree with a licensing. So the licensing is at 3,000 clinical hours supervised by another licensed clinician or psychologist, and then a commitment as with any licensing or certification, you have to perform so many CEUs every year, so many consultation hours and that kind of thing to maintain your license. And a psychologist is a doctorate level. So it's a 4-year versus the 3-year. Well, I think 3-year, some degrees try to pull it off in 2, but 3-year degree. And it's practically speaking, they're not dissimilar from each other at all. It's similar practice, similar education, but as a psychologist, you are able to do testing, school testing, and some other things that require that level of a doctorate. You can become tenured if you're a professor. I couldn't become tenured. So it didn't offer more to me that I felt I needed. And the MSW that I got, which was through BU, was at that time an integration of organizational psychology and clinical psychology. So I was able to practice both of my loves, which is, you know, some of the administrative opportunities I've had, consulting opportunities, and then I specialized then into the clinical later on. So I liked that model and that wasn't offered. But now there's a menu of different, I mean, there's neuropsychologists, there's neurology based social work, there's neurological researchers, there's all sorts of kind of different hybrids that you can do that. So it's pretty exciting time, I think, to be in this work. And yeah, I might choose something different now. What was that?
It's very needed.
Mm-hmm. It is. The need is only going up. And I think part of it is people are getting comfortable with the idea of health, mental health and physical health are not, you can't have one without the other. Muscling through with an anxious brain and muscling through with a depressed brain or sad brain is not a wholehearted, complete life any more than, you know, the doctor telling you you have a, you know, a stress fracture and you're just going to, I'm just going to muscle through for the rest of my life and just deal with this pain. When you can change and heal and body and mind, I mean, anxiety, depression, they affect blood pressure, you know, they affect inflammation in your body. The list of things that are impacted by the mind and its health are exponential. I know you know that. And so they have to be talking to each other, and we have to be concerned with the health of both. And so I think with more acceptance of that, the integration of health and even the recognition of it, even at the insurance level, that these are of equal merit, I appreciate, because it's encouraging people in its way to attend in equal part to the health of their mind as with their body, as with what you do, kind of is a point of integration of the two, which I appreciate.
Mm. So now we've had COVID, mm-hmm. and more people had to stay home, and then less kind of those activities that would maybe drown out the sadness, and depression and anxiety. And so maybe someone who was imbalanced before is feeling it even more, mm-hmm. being at home and maybe not being in a safe environment. Mm-hmm. So what are some things, I guess there's so many ways we could look at this. What are some things that people could look for to know that maybe they're starting to become imbalanced?
Well, you know, one of the things we have to be in a state of, if we're going to be engaged in self-care, is what I call a state of notice. So you have to have pauses in your life, an open space of opportunity to reflect upon yourself. And so I think ingredient one is pause. And don't be afraid of the pause. It is in the pause that we hear ourselves, that we notice ourselves. And it can be on a long walk. It can be in a mindfulness exercise. It can be, on a bike ride, a horseback ride, whatever. But be in your body and mind for a minute and be in a state of notice and put a pause button over your week and your day. We live a lot of our life unconsciously. A lot.
A lot.
Yep. Too much. And that can be okay if we're firing on most of our cylinders and we're scooching in the direction of what we want more of. That can look pretty healthy, but we've got to get more into a relationship of consciousness with ourselves and a state of notice. And that is the first ingredient in changing anything. But in that state of notice, you might collect data like, I am not talking to my friends as much as I was. As a matter of fact, I kind of don't want to. I am noticing that I am on a steady diet of news and not watching, for me, Little House on the Prairie, but, or I am eating foods that are more sugar carb based, and I am not exercising as much. I am not sleeping. Sleeping is a big place where we harbor our psychological damage and interruptions in sleep, sleeping excessive amounts or sleeping too little. But changes in things like that are, changes in our weight can be a sign that we are holding a lot of anxious and sad energy in our body, because that results in a retention of sugar. And so it's all one, but you have to start with a state of notice and then collect data on what do I say I want my life to look like, and am I scooching in that direction? And if you're not, then that's a place when you can begin to have a conversation with yourself about quality improvement. Like, how do I want to consciously begin to choose behaviors and choose attachments that facilitate my moving in the direction of what I say I want more of, instead of away from?
So What about the people who like literally cannot pause? Like it would feel dangerous to them that cannot pause.
Yeah. So you have to start wherever someone's at. And that's very common. You know, when I taught a course, a college course, I don't know how many years ago now, 10 years ago, I think. One of my assignments to the class was that they could either spend an hour in silence, no music, no phone, no nothing. They could go sit somewhere in nature if they wanted to. They could sit in the room. They could go for a drive if they knew where they were going and they weren't going to use GPS. Gave them some parameters. And I said, you can do that for an hour, or you can write me a 5-page research paper on mindfulness. Your choice. More than half the class chose the paper. And even of the kids that chose to do the mindfulness exercise, maybe a third of them made it through the whole hour.
Mm.
It was terrifying. Some of the kids right away said, there's no way I'm doing that. They knew it.
Mm.
Our body and brain are meant to have moments of pause and listening.
Yeah.
Without that, we are living a very largely unconscious life. But consciousness is a muscle. And so you have to gain it. And so a lot of times where I start with folks is using things like movement-based mindfulness, things like guided meditation, reading a provocative, like some of my younger folk, I encourage them on Spotify, there's Daily Wellness, which is a thought followed by 3 songs, because songs have an immediate impact on our limbic system. So there's a secondary gain there for me when they're getting involved with that. But using art and really data input and noise of the body by telling the body has to do something different and uniquely to get the frontal lobe to kind of take a step back and let us be in our body. And sometimes the exercises you start with folks are 30 seconds, 10 seconds, 20 seconds with little guys.
Whatever
sometimes,
they can handle.
Yeah, you start right there. But as you expand, it's a muscle. It's a muscle of ability that we are not. And in this society, our attention span has been reduced so profoundly. Wasn't there a TV network they recently came up with that had 10-minute episodes that resolved in 10 minutes? It didn't succeed. And I see that as a hopeful sign, but we're not having enough opportunity to exercise our muscle of notice and of pause and of listening. And I think, you know, in yoga, when I first went to try to do yoga, one of my first things was like, it's really hard for me to stop my brain from being really busy. But indeed, if you get involved in the activities of being present in yourself, you will see the muscle gets better, but you have to start where you're at. And sometimes that's a very brief one. I have a pendulum exercise where you hold up a string with a pendulum at the bottom, that I borrowed from, Alexander and Ellen Simpkins do this activity in their classes. And you can move the pendulum with your mind, hold it still, and just say to yourself, go forward and back, just in your head. Just think it as hard as you can. And the pendulum will move.
Yeah, forward and back. Always moves. Yeah.
And sides, and you can do it in circles. I'm working on a figure eight. I haven't gotten it yet, but I'm working on it. But even that for kids, it's so fascinating to them that even a child with attentional challenges can pause in that moment. And that is a moment of notice. And then you can reflect on that. And that, I think, is the muscle you try to grow to get people into a conscious relationship with themselves, scanning and noticing and taking data in their body and their mind about their balance and their wellness. But you have to grow it from where it starts. Yeah.
Yeah. I know that through COVID, I've had to kind of change up a little bit of how I teach. And it's like task-based stuff. Like we're going to pick up a foot and look anywhere in the room and see if you can stay balanced, you know, and let them kind of have to stay present that way instead of their mind going, oh my God, I hate this. I can't do it. I don't want to be in this place of my mind and kind of go from there.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I have a question about kids right now. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I have this worry that like my kids are old enough. They've sort of their teens, they've had their life kind of pre-teen and childhood, youngsters. Mm-hmm. And they're kind of saying like, oh, it'll be interesting to see how this COVID period of time goes into the history books of like, we experienced it. And I wonder what they're going to say in the history books. And then you have the little children, the really small kids who are having to put on masks and not be around a lot of people, not hug people as much, even friends. And so to them, that's their new level of safety. And I don't know what's going to happen in years to come when those masks come off, when they are able to hug people, if that is going to feel unsafe to them, where it's going to put them into this state of fight or flight because all they knew was before. Yeah. How, what are your thoughts and feelings about what this future is going to be like? And maybe what we can do now so that that gets a little bit easier for them later.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I see a lot of that concern. And I would say across all of the ages of youngsters, one of the things you want to give them during this time is a sense of efficacy and power, autonomy, and have them notice that how they are in service to the greater good by wearing this mask, and really compliment them on that and have them notice it's so good to see you taking care of other people this way. That's really neat. Good for you. So noticing a sense of power in this time when everything's telling us we're powerless, there's so many things are trying to tell us we are. And saying to ourselves, you know, if it's older children in the election, how can you be powerful? How can you be an advocate? How can you get your voice out there? If it's younger kids, how can you, you know, cheer up people that maybe are alone by sending letters to some of the nursing homes, maybe where people can't get out, or going there and showing them your Halloween costumes? Find ways for kids to be powerful developmentally appropriately. And I think that's one thing that we don't commiserate, don't feed the myth that they are powerless in making COVID whatever they choose to make COVID. There's a lot of cool things about this time. I've seen families and attachments renewed. And one of the biggest things I was concerned about pre-COVID was the absence. There's a really good book called Hold On to Your Kids by Gordon Neufeld and Gabor Mate, who they're one's a doctor, the other one's a psychologist, but they talk about the damage of attachment in the current cohort and the inopportunity for healthy attachment and early attachment. And I have been concerned that the opportunities for attachment have been diminished somewhat, and that peers have substituted for the attachment of family and parents and grandparents and things like that. Well, there's this COVID opportunity for that I'm seeing for some families, not all, but to create these really cool attachments, to find out that they can't do their kids' math, and that's hysterical. So I think that it's the opportunity for attachment here is a gift, and we could take great advantage of it to create more secure and I guess longitudinally healthier attachments with our kids. So I would say power, it's make them powerful wherever and however developmentally appropriately they can be. Use this time to facilitate different and deeper attachment and healthy attachment. Even with those teens who perhaps seem like they don't want that, they do. And be ready to make a fool of yourself to get it, you know, get in there and try. In terms of the masks and not being willing to help, you make a good point. We create neurological template when we ever, you know, pair or touch our neurons together. So when we touch together hugging and a lack of safety, we are creating a neural pathway that says hugging isn't safe. But neurons, the cool thing about this is you can create neural touching or neural connection by just imagining. If you practice the piano and I practice the piano in my mind on the same song, the neurological change in us is almost the same. You might have more motor development because you use your fingers as you're, you know, on the keys. But if I'm moving my fingers as if I'm playing it, I get the same. So imagining touching, imagining hugging. So having your child come home at the end of the day, if they comment that or don't, or telling them a story at night where you say, let's imagine giving your friends all a hug goodnight. And keeping that template for hugging being a good and positive thing, and keeping that touch in your own family. You know, having tickle moments or having time when touch is high and a part of your activity, all of that matters. So you're not wrong that we might have to do some kind of renegotiating with the amygdala and with the limbic system about what touch and absence of masks means. But we have had a lot more time without that than with it. And little guys' plasticity is so profound that they change so quickly.
Oh, okay. That's good.
Yeah. And so they're,
Sorry, go ahead.
No, their ability to change compared to yours or mine is, you know, and you're probably better than me because I think you're a little younger, but, you know, little guys change on a dime, and some of the therapies like EMDR work with them so effectively and so profoundly because they do have such supple plasticity and they do get new neurology so quickly. So their need to relearn something different after this will be very available to us. And then we have to be conscious about making sure we do rewire that. But there's things you could do now just by practicing in the mind a good relationship with touch.
I love that. So what about, isn't there a part of the brain that reads expression, people's expressions? So do you think that that's being lost in school or for children to read the expressions of the teachers, of the other students, or maybe not seeing it as well on a screen versus in person? Or will they get it better by reading eyes and expressions through the eyes? Or is this, again, this thing where they're just going to bounce right back because their plasticity is so good?
It will largely bounce back because their plasticity is so good. But here's the other thing. We are so dependent, overly dependent and confident in our primary senses and in our ability to read things. And we very commonly in this unconscious journey of us learn to read things wrong or become apathetic or lazy about our readings. So this is really an opportunity for kids to use new muscles and people to use new muscles.
Yeah.
To create different metadata and collect different metadata. You know, if I come into the room grumpy, my dog knows it. They don't need to look at my face. They can feel it. They can smell it. They're just like, oh, okay, let's give her some space. We have more ability to collect metadata than we give ourselves credit for. And our bodies and brains are constantly collecting so much data that we don't even use and that we are not ever really aware of. And we can do much more than we give ourselves credit without seeing things like the lower part of our face.
I love it.
For me, it's a chance to strengthen muscles we've been neglectful of in terms of collecting emotional and facial data. And I think that the ability to read the bottom part of the face is going to come back in no time at all, but maybe we'll have a strengthening of other information and a deepening of empathy and compassion with the rest of our body that we've been a little bit neglectful of.
So good. You know, this is relieving, right?
Yeah.
I agree. I feel like the COVID time was a good reset for people to be with their families more. I mean, there's a lot of bad that came out of COVID, but I think there's a lot of good as well. Being with their families, being able to do these things like strengthen other things, like even for me as a business owner, having to come up with different ways to run the business, you know, those are different muscles in the brain, there's more creative pathways.
To that end, I think any trauma in our lives, whether it be this societal experience or a personal trauma, it is never diminishing the negative and the hard parts of it to say that it will be what you make of it. That is true of everything. And so we have this opportunity to say, I'm going to find the fruit that I can pluck from this really unhealthy tree, and I'm going to take that fruit with me in my future. That's what this opportunity is, like any trauma opportunity. And, you know, we had talked a little bit about polyvagal theory and trauma brain and vagal, you know, kind of balance and mitigation, staying in that ventral vagal state. We can talk more about that. But I feel like this is an opportunity for us to learn balance and self-regulation, increase and hold on to attachment, expand. I was saying to you earlier, I don't think I would have ever gotten involved with telehealth had I not had this experience. And now it's opened this whole window of attachment, particularly with my younger people. And I'm getting better at it. You know, the data that I used to collect in the room that I thought I couldn't collect anywhere else, even my old brain is getting better at collecting metadata through a screen. And we all are, you know, so
Yeah. So let's talk about, well, let's talk about the polyvagal theory. So maybe let's explain the polyvagal theory developed by Stephen Porges, and then this neurological therapy that you do, which maybe the differences between the two and why you use what you use, although you've kind of already explained that, but yeah.
Well, Stephen Porges came up with polyvagal theory as a way of talking about the ventral vagal nervous system, which converses between our brain and our more primal brain, that limbic emotional brain. And I'm going to really take this down a notch in terms of all the parts of the brain that are involved. Right. So bear with me. And it takes it down to the regulating of that ventral nervous system that has a lot to do with regulating our heartbeat, our digestion, our reproductive system, a lot of the things that collect a lot of harm when we are in a state of anxiety, depression, perpetual sense of PTSD, whatever. That ventral vagal nervous system is not running properly. And what Stephen Porges talks about is moving us back to a ventral vagal state, which is a safe and connected state. So a sense of safety and balance and well-being, not necessarily happiness, but more of a calm and a balanced sensation where we can connect with other people and connect in an easy way. And we collect good metadata in that state. And when we are triggered, we move more into the sympathetic state of the vagus system, which is more the fight flight system and a sense of disconnection. And that is more sense that is our anxious place, and our sensory system experiences that in various ways. Some people feel it more of a I want to run and I want to move or scream, but some of us feel it more as a I want to retreat and run away, and that can look more like a freeze, but really it's more of a runaway. It's an escape. So that kind of falls under that sympathetic triggered state. And then the dorsal state, which is disconnection, demobilization, all the way down to catatonia, meaning that's when we really have an absence of the valuing of any kind of connection with others, and a complete shutdown really of collecting really any metadata, or we collect very little. And that's usually a very significant level of depression. What Porges talks about is moving back through the systems by using regulation of that vagus nervous system. And I would recommend, if anybody wants to understand the theory, there's some great podcasts out there that Stephen is being interviewed about. And he's even talking about COVID. So specifically in terms of the ventral vagal. So you can go look that up. But Deb Dana offers a nice template. And it's in a therapy book, but she offers the polyvagal therapy theory in therapy is a more, user-friendly guide to the vagus nervous system and how to regulate it. And it gives really concrete tools like to use. She uses a ladder image and how to be in a state of notice of your triggers, and then how to regulate yourself through those triggers. And by finding other things, as you were saying earlier, other things that pull us back into our ventral vagal self. So an example would be, I watch the news, I get upset about the state of things and the election or the anger that I see on the TV. I get worked up. What could I do? And I begin to have kind of a sympathetic experience. My body does. I get anxious. I feel tense. My neck feels tight. What can I do right then to remove myself from that sympathetic state? Go talk, call my friend and be like, oh my gosh, did you see blah, blah, blah? Immediately, if I could scan my ventral vagal nervous system, but also that limbic system, attachment and that connection brings us down and brings that vagus system to a more calm place. And a lot of what he talks about is using attachment and using co-regulation between you and I. So if I were really upset, and you greeted me with your neural state of, wow, that's really hard, but I'm going to just sit here and be calm and present with you. Eventually, my vagus nervous system will align with you and will come meet you. If you get worked up with me, we're both going to get worked up, but even through attachment, we might bring it back down. The reason that I have really enjoyed this, the theory, it gives a real usefulness to helping people understand why they have to be in that conscious place and be in a relationship with their body and their brain where they are regulating for the health of body and mind. But, and I think Deb Dana's makes it even more useful in a therapeutic setting in terms of tools, which is really great. The reason I do more what I think of as neurological therapy with this integrated into it 100% is that it's a little more complex process than that. And I believe in cognitive behavioral therapy in terms of you have to get back to thought swapping. And I believe in trauma-based therapy like EMDR, because we can regulate all we want. If you don't change a trauma-based false belief and flip it to, and when I say trauma, by the way, I mean little T's and big T's. I mean, you know, missing the bus when you're 7 years old, missing the school bus and your mom already went to work and you come home and there's nobody there. That can be a little T, you know, that can be a trauma. So little T's and big T's file false beliefs in us. I'm powerless. I'm alone. I don't matter. Things like that. You also have to go in and modify those thoughts. So I feel like for me, neurological therapy is an integration of understanding the incredible complexity of the brain and the central nervous system and how to be in the driver's seat of it in our lives a little bit and in a conversational relationship with ours so that we can become as healthy as we can be and accepting of where we maybe aren't as strong, you know, and engage in some self-love around that, self-compassion.
So I know in yoga, I talk a lot about how if you don't use it, you lose it. So truly, if there is a body part, and I use the hip as an example, because we do things that are in a linear fashion, right? Mm-hmm. Like walking, running, cycling, anything, bike riding, right? Where it's this like front forward leg. Mm-hmm. And we're not using it going into another rotation, another area, you lose that. Your body is smart. It has this reptilian piece of it where it says, I need to keep you safe. I need to keep you alive. So you're not using that. I'm going to shut it down.
Yeah.
So you're saying the same thing happens in the brain.
Yes. Yeah. They're all one. Absolutely. Yeah. You're talking about a really unconscious relationship with our bodies, which people get into all the time. And then they get, you know, not even a little older. It can happen at any time. But, I remember even when I was younger, when I went and I was playing basketball and my coach at Colby said, are you aware that you like are barely using the left-hand side of your body? It wasn't until actually I got into yoga that I realized how imbalanced I was in my body. It was unbelievable. And for somebody who had mustered through, and we can push through. We can push through without attending to all these things, but they will catch up with you. Mm-hmm. And they will reduce your ability to live your fullest and most wholehearted life. And that's the journey that we're on. You never get there. There's no there. But that journey is to our best selves, never to perfection, because it doesn't exist, but always to our best selves. So yeah, that attention to understanding balance and understanding consciousness, a conscious relationship with ourselves, then you're sitting in the driver's seat of your body and mind, and then you can make some conscious choices about trying to create more balance and regulation.
Sitting in the driver's seat of your body and mind. I love it. Yeah. That's exactly what we need to do.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know if this is your expertise, but you may see this. So a lot of people are in pain, like physical pain.
Yeah.
And I know that pain does not always necessarily equal tissue damage. Mm-hmm. So it probably means that their sympathetic nervous system is maybe just turned on too long, or their alarm system for pain is triggered for something smaller. Mm-hmm. Do you see people like that? Like, is it not always the mental, emotional, it's this physical pain that you have to somehow figure out what's going on with the nervous system?
It's always like that.
Okay.
Yeah. It always shows up in both places. And, a medical statistic that came out about 5 years ago is that they stated that 80% of illness is completely mind-based or profoundly exacerbated by mind-based. Mm-hmm. so many of the gut and inflammation diseases and issues that we have are related to our brain being in a toxic state of hypervigilance.
Well, so it thinks it's in harm. It's in the state always. Of I'm going to be harmed. So yeah. Everything inflames, the nervous systems get stuck in that state. Okay.
Yeah. We retain too much, you know, sugar, our heart rate is not as regulated as it might be, up or down. I mean, the list of things, the damage that we do to our body through a lack of psychological wellness or brain wellness is unbelievable. You can Google it. It's a long list. And so, yeah, we have to be in a state of attending to the physical, because the physical is body and mind are one. One of the exercises I will have people do is take this body sheet and try to find emotions in their body, just to talk, to have their brain talk to their body about where this stuff's showing up. So many people have gut-based issues. Well, 80% of your serotonin comes from the gut. But when you're anxious, or if you're in that sympathetic state or that hypervigilant state, your gut, your reproductive system, all sorts of things shut down and blood gets sent elsewhere. And if we stay in that state, we don't digest well. What if we don't digest well? We don't get enough building blocks to the neurochemicals we need to be happy or balanced. It's all one. And so, yeah, physical stuff, absolutely. You know, there's research that shows that if you take a magnifying glass, say your ankle is injured and swollen, and you look backwards through a magnifying glass and you look at your ankle for a while, so it looks like it's far away, so far away that it couldn't possibly be your ankle. It hurts less and the swelling goes down. I mean, this is the, you know,
the brain is powerful. And I think that the thing that people don't realize is that when you bump into something or step on something, the first thing it does is go into the spinal cord, and then it goes into the brain and it goes, have I seen this before? Mm-hmm. Is this safe? Yes or no. And then it's going to send back the signal of pain. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So same could be true with emotional experiences, right?
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, I think Porges references the word neuroception, but the idea that, you know, there's a great series on called Brain Games. I don't know if you've ever watched it.
No.
I'm a bit of an addict, but it shows you all the perceptual games that your brain plays to try to collect all this plethora of data that it gets bombarded with through every sense all day long. It has to be selective. It can't collect it all.
Yeah,
and so here's the thing. If you leave your house in the morning and you are in a hypervigilant state, like maybe the world's not safe, maybe not, I'm not okay, maybe I'm not good enough, whatever the glasses you're wearing when you leave the house. And I leave my house with glasses of I'm a good person. I'm promise you I'm doing the best I can, and I'm open to quality improvement. Mm-hmm. And I think the world is more good than not good. And we both leave, the data we collect all day long, Lisa, is going to be so different. Yeah. So different. And the hypervigilant, the world's not safe, I'm not okay, I'm not good enough, that is a trauma experience to your body and brain that will show up in your body in terms of stomach ache, in terms of neck pain, in terms of back pain, in terms of, you know, in your knee. I mean, it can show up anywhere. Mm-hmm. One of the activities I will do with some people sometimes is I'll have them close their eyes, take a few deep breaths and kind of feel themselves in their chair. And then I'll ask them to notice an itch on their body. And we can always find one.
You can always find
it. Terrible.
I know.
And then
I'm actually at the point where I don't itch it. And I go, that's not there. Because as soon as you itch it, there's an itch somewhere else. And then there's an itch somewhere else, right?
So, but then what you can do is when you find the itch, don't touch it, but move it with your mind. Mm-hmm. Move the itch from your knee to the side of your face. And then move it to the top of your head. And just notice that we are in this incredible data collecting, you know, bombarding experience, and we got to get in there and drive. If we don't, it really is the experience of the body and brain that it's being bombarded, and our brain will get very busy in becoming selective of its data. And if our data tells, if the lens we're wearing through life is I'm not good enough, the world's not safe, your brain will collect that data. That's what it's looking for. One of the brain games is this group of people with red shirts and white shirts throwing balls around, and they say, count how many times the people in white shirts catch the ball. While that's happening, a person in a large gorilla suit walks right through the group. At the end, when you poll people, did anybody see the gorilla? Almost always, no one, maybe a couple people out of 100 see the gorilla. You know, so we see what we get prepared to collect data on. And so setting your lens before you even leave in the morning with either mindfulness, meditation, breathing, a moment of consciousness, when you say, how would I like to greet my life? How would I like to greet my day? This is a conscious decision to collect better data. And in the end, it makes us healthier, safer, more ready, and more capable, not less.
Yeah. And I think it seems hard at first for people to do that. Yes. Like, I don't want to put my state of mind in there. I'm just going to let experiences hit me and I'm going to react that way. Right. So they think it would conserve more energy to react than set the tone initially. And I think that once they do going forward, it's just going to be an automatic thing that, you know, that will take less energy than they think.
Well, that the lie that our amygdala and our limbic system tell us is that that hypervigilant state or even depressed state is somehow keeping us safer, more ready, more capable. And the complete opposite is true, that from a more positive place and a more calm place and more balanced place, we have the resilience, body and mind, to do a better job handling, figuring out and managing, being capable of whatever. And that greeting the world with positivity, when negative things happen, you find the fruit. You're like, yeah, that sucked, but but if you greet it with a negative mind, you go, wah, wah, you know, that's exactly what I expected. People try to safeguard themselves with a bracing for the bad things, thinking that that's got them more ready. And that's more realistic. Things that brace get pushed over. Rigidity does not help us. And a sense of bracing does not help us. Balance comes from a positive and a calm mindset. And we have to work for that. That is a muscular state that our brain, we are predisposed towards collecting negative data. We have a negativity bias in our brain that has to do with what you said, survival. It's that primal brain that says it's the bad stuff that's going to get you, so watch for it. To choose to be in a more positive mindset, you have to be conscious. And the first sales pitch I always have to give with people is that that actually makes you safer, healthier, more ready, and more capable. And I think that that's the part that people, you know, have to fight through first before they begin to practice positivity, mindfulness, and a kind of a balanced approach to choosing themselves, choosing their behavior. I first have to confront that guard at the gate, which is I'm going to make myself more vulnerable, less safe, less capable by doing this.
But it's our own guard. Right?
It is. But if,
okay.
But if you're not conscious of the guard, you think that that guard is what we call reality or truth. And it's not. You know, if we really did a better job of handling our lives and managing things in a state of hypervigilance or even shutdown, we would have all of our first responders and medical people and emergency folks learn how to panic. Like, we'd be like, yeah, you really need to be panicky. But we don't. We teach them to desensitize to the triggers and the data that stimulate them so they can stay in their frontal lobe and make choices in the moment.
That's such a good point. That's such a good point. So in yoga, I know a lot of yoga tries to get people into this parasympathetic state like the whole hour.
Yeah.
And you know, when you think about that, that's not what you want. Like, you don't want them to be in the parasympathetic and then they walk out and like, someone turns on their car and it does the boop, boop, and the lights flash and it like takes them so far out of that parasympathetic that they can't even handle that small, you know, nervous system change.
Yeah.
So our bodies are constantly going, we want a healthy nervous system is going to take us in and out of that constantly. Like, I know the inhalation, the sympathetic, the exhalation is the parasympathetic. So every single breath we take, these 25,000 breaths we take a day, we're going in and out of those. The problem becomes when we can't get out of one of those states.
You know, you make a great, and one of the things I love about some of the mindfulness activities I've done have really promoted giving yourself permission to be in and out of that state and not see it as a failure when you are not constantly in that, you know, kind of calm and mindful and present state. A lot of people give up just because really there's a lot of muscle gained in the in and out and the consciousness of that journey and being a part of that. So I think that's really important to do those exercises. And to my experience of it is spending most of the time in yoga going in and out of my busy brain to my calm brain, and being accepting and giving permission to myself for that, and not getting upset with myself about that, and noticing that that's a way that I'm still preparing my brain and my body for being conscious throughout the day and for being in a state of choice and choosing calm. But I do think, you know, things like that we do need to regulate and shrink is that amygdala, you know, that's one of the most unconscious bullies in our brain. And through yoga, through breathing, through mindfulness, through getting to that ventral vagal state of bringing the heart rate down and the respiration rate down, getting your body to do that throughout the day periodically is a way of, there was a study they did 6 weeks, people not experienced in mindfulness meditation, anything like that, just doing 4-7-8 breathing for 6 weeks, three times a day. Each breathing exercise was 4 repetitions of 4-7-8. So in for 4, hold for 7, out for 8, 4 in a row, doing that 3 times a day. They did that for 6 weeks and scanned the brain before and after and saw amygdala shrinking or a lack of connectedness, a thinning, if you will, in the amygdala, which is for us meaning a calmer amygdala. And that that amygdala that's so important in so many of our emotions and our extreme emotions is healthier when it's not running, you know, at a high, at a 20 or 30 all day long, but running closer to a 0 to 10. So that when we respond to things, we respond at a 30, 40 instead of an 80, 90, you know, and really lose it. So
it's interesting that they would do longer of a, so they are holding the breath in, in the sympathetic state instead of holding it out.
Yeah. So it's really, it's in for 4. So it's a full breath. It's a hold for 7. And that's a mindful moment. When I teach it to
people. Yeah, I'm surprised it's a breath in, like it's holding a breath in instead of holding a breath out.
Yeah. And then it's the very slow push out to 8. Slow being the core thing. But there's square breathing. You know, a lot of different breathing techniques. Regulation of breath and consciousness of our breath is a great tool for thinning that amygdala, but also putting ourselves in a relationship with our body and that vagus nervous system and our fight, flight, freeze kind of anxiety system. It's a really important part of it is to be, the mistake a lot of people make is they try to do breathing exercises in the middle of anxiety.
Yeah.
And that's not how it works. You do those exercises outside of those moments to get yourself into a conscious relationship with your body.
Right.
And sometimes when you're in anxiety, the best thing you can do if you're really having panic is run around, get on the treadmill, like do some jumping. To say to your body, we're getting away. We're okay. Hmm. The amygdala is a very dumb part. It's very primal and it just knows you're moving. And so it will say, oh, okay, we're good then, you know, and there's a lot of things like, you know, the weighted blankets and the, you know, snugglies and things like that, that make people feel safer. That's playing to that amygdala primacy of noticing that being held and that pressure means a sense of safety. So there's a lot of activities that you can do with your body and with your breathing that regulate and really help with keeping that amygdala in a healthier, thinner state, thinned out, meaning connectively, so that it's not running on red all the time. And that really is a big barrier to getting in the driver's seat. When that amygdala is revving high, it's very hard to keep our thoughts under control and to keep our negative thoughts under control. It makes it an uphill battle.
I love all the talk about the brain.
I love brains.
They're so interesting and fascinating, and the way they process information is just amazing because everyone is completely different. And it's hard to do studies on pain because everyone's threshold is different. So there can be no constant data, you know. But I have heard of the research experiment where they had a blue probe and they said this is going to be cold. And when they touched the skin, it was cold and it was just totally normal temperature. And the same thing, a red one, people thought it was hot. So I guess the last thing I want to talk about was self-love. Mm-hmm. So how does one start to really feel this, like I am worthy mm-hmm. to not feel pain. I am worthy to not have these experiences of anxiety or depression. Mm-hmm. I feel worthy enough to have a great life and find those good mm-hmm. roots.
Yeah. And you know, a lot of people think of self-love as kind of an egocentric or cocky state. It's absolutely not. It's a responsible state. It's taking responsibility for who we are and who we could be. Is you know, that state of self-love. And love for me, self-love is kind of different components. One is self-compassion. Another is commitment to self-care. And another is acceptance of our imperfection and embracing it even. And I feel like the things that get in the way of people embracing the idea of self-love is, I don't want to be cocky. It won't work. I won't work as hard in my life. I won't push myself as hard if I don't beat myself a bit. You know, the idea that we've got to kind of self-flagellate to get ourselves to work hard. And mm-hmm. and another myth that the amygdala tells us is that we won't be safe from the judgment of others if we love ourselves. We got to get ready for the bad stuff that people are going to send our way and be concerned with judgment and comparison, which are always, to me, the death of joy, you know? Yeah. So it's really noticing that in a true state of self-love, it is about compassion for yourself. It is about care of yourself, and it is about acceptance. And that is a really responsible place to start from. From that place, you can become the best you that you can deliver to this world. And that is, to me, what I think should be and what we might want. So to get in that state, you have to, you know, I use an example sometimes with folks of just having them look at one body part and say, you know, look at your hand and what do you see? And if you look at your hand, Lisa, what do you see? Just say three things.
Broad, strong. Yeah. And a story.
Okay, cool. So that's really integration. Broad is acceptance of the shape of your hand or whatever. And then you really are compassionate with yourself and accepting and loving of what, you know, taking care of what your hand is doing for you, of the story it tells, of its strength. That's really cool. Most people, statistically, we would say probably at least 50%, but it may be more, would look at their hand and say, I see age spots, I see wrinkles, I see swollen knuckles, I see dirty fingernails, you know, whatever. It's looking at your whole body, like I'm going to ask you to look at your hand, which just say, thank you, hand, for doing every amazing thing that you do. Thank you for the story that the lines tell. Thank you for the things you're going to do for me in the future. It makes me want to take care of you, hand, because you are going to, I want you to work for me in the future because you do so many cool things. Thank you for being able to feel around on the ground for a lost earring and notice it with your fingertips, but at the same time, be so tough that you can stack wood and not hurt your finger. I mean, what a cool thing our hand is, you know? Mm-hmm. It's looking at things and our whole body and our mind that way. Oh my God, how cool is all this stuff?
Yeah.
And how much do I love it? And it's acceptance of the things about yourself. Like, I was never going to be a ballerina. I was never going to be a gymnast, you know? And that's because I'm supposed to be something else.
Else, right. Yeah.
So it's really accepting all the gifts that this is. And when you love it, you take care of it. The stuff you don't love and you don't care about, you lose, you break, you neglect, you know? The stuff we care about, the stuff we love, we take care of. So it works out quite nicely that if we practice self-acceptance, self-compassion, self-care, we will get to our best self, right? Mm-hmm. So that's my sales pitch.
I love that. When you love it, you will take care of it. When you love your body, when you love your parts, you'll take care of it.
Yeah.
That's a great way to end.
Good. Well, I really enjoyed this. I enjoyed the attachment and the exchange. I think my ventral vagus nervous system is really connected and really happy. So thank you.
And it flew by.
It did.
I thank you so much for your time. I know that you are so busy doing your work and helping everybody during this time. So I just thank you to put this together for the community and hopefully beyond that will listen to this that can really get something out of understanding what's our role, what's our brain's role, and how we can kind of override that and just be happier and healthier.
Awesome. Thanks for giving me a chance. And thank you for doing this. I'm really glad that you're doing this for everybody. So thank you. You're wonderful.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. Brenda was so kind to give us her time for this interview. And I do hope to continue to bring to you people that really can add value to these times for you, especially those of you that can't really get out of the house and really don't know where to go to even start. So that's what these episodes are all about. I did include Brenda's website. So if you're looking for help, she is busy currently, but will help guide you to the right place should you need it. If you're looking for anything Ohana, our website is ohanayoganh.com. And you can find all that we're about, all of our online offerings, all of our in-studio offerings, and all that we have going on right now for the end of the year as well as the holidays. So I love you all very, very much and hope that you have the best day. Bye-bye.